Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on August 19th, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Allow me to introduce first the thinking man's blockbuster master, auteur behind Memento, The Prestige, Inception, The Dark Knight Trilogy, and a really good little movie called Following that Zeitgeist distributed long before anyone knew who he was. One of the very few filmmakers who can get name checked anywhere on the planet, Christopher Nolan. And as well, of course, as the brothers, who are authors by my lights of at least two or three of the greatest short films ever produced in the 120-year history of the medium, Timothy and Stephen Quay.
I don't want to go in the middle because then I'd have to pretend I could tell you apart. kicking off, the one thing Mike didn't say that I just want to point out is this is actually the first commercial movie that I ever played a film in as well, and I'm delighted to see they've still got their 35mm projectors, and what an amazing job they've done tonight presenting these films, so thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of staggered having just, you know, sat through the presentation. The only one of those films I'd been able to see a film print of previously is The Comb, many years ago at the ICA in London. And to see Street of Crocodiles presented, you know, the way it was originally made, I mean, it's a stunning, stunning experience.
It's rare.
I was going to say,
it's rare. Have
a lot of people had the opportunity to see these on film, or is this feels like a very unique event in that regard? I certainly have been seeking out, you know, your film since I was a teenager. I first saw Street of Crocodiles. I caught it on public television late one night in the days before it would tell you what was on. And I looked at these images. I had absolutely no idea what I'd seen. And it took me a couple of years to actually figure out, you know, who you were and you'd made it. But I'd never been able to actually see it in a theater. Like In Absentia, have people got to see that before?
I think In Absentia was seen once at the Barbican and just
really
died. Yeah. It was fabulous because they actually wired the chairs with his sound.
Really?
So it shook. So people were galvanized by they couldn't forget Stockhausen for sure.
The synchronization between the music and the image in that film, I think, is remarkable. You've said that you worked to the track from Stockhausen. I'm going to ask you to explain that a little bit, but was he aware of the narrative that you were constructing, the narrative about the girl in the insane asylum? I mean, perhaps you could explain that story a little bit to the audience. I promise I won't ask you what it all means.
No.
But it does have a very moving story behind it.
I mean, for you who don't know, that originally there were four filmmakers. It started off, the BBC commissioned four musicians to write the music first. Then four film directors were brought on board. And so most people have the music done afterwards, usually. But this fell perfectly into our hands because we've always worked with music first. The only thing that Stockhausen, we had to send, the BBC asked us to send a few images of work that we'd done. I don't think he could be bothered. You know, I didn't have the time and said, fine, it's okay with me, do it. And we didn't tell him the scenario or anything. Did we? No, what we'd seen was an exhibition probably a year earlier at the Hayward Gallery in London, which had, it was an exhibition of the Prinzhorn collection from Heidelberg, which were mad artists from what was called Beyond Reason, the exhibition. And it was, there were three works by Emma Halk, which really, you know, it was, they were very moving. I think we just stored it mentally. And then when the Stockhausen film, the commission came up, we said, we just looked at each other and said, it's got to be Emma Halk. We're going to do something, sort of an imaginary documentary. Hardly anything was known about other than that she was in the asylum, early 20s, died there, schizophrenia. These were letters to her husband, which we found out much later, after we made the film, they never reached the husband. So our hunch that the letters just went into a void in inside the clock proved a good hunch.
Oh, you didn't know?
No,
that.
We didn't know that. Didn't. It oh. just came out later that...
And it was only later that, after the film was made, that a photograph was produced of her. Up to that point, we'd never seen an image of her.
Yeah.
And it was in the Prinzhorn collection did it. So we're in close contact with them the whole time.
And what is the sentence she was writing?
Darling, come.
Come. And he never came. Because the letters were never passed to the husband, who said, I think it was something like, when she gets better, I'll come. And she never got better. So that was it. So she just said, well, so what you see at the very end, you do actually see, it was a photocopy, because we couldn't get the original. But we panned down the it was just a wall of graphite written over top like 1,000 times. Darling, come, 1,000 times on a field of gray graphite. So, and they were all like that. All her letters were like that.
And so, in the Stockhausen music, where you hear a woman crying and laughing, that's you weren't inspired by that to tell. I'm sorry, you'd already decided on that. That's just a serendipity.
I think that fell nicely into.
Very nice.
The pain.
Well, I think once you realize, because Stockhausen had two wives,
and they're both singing.
They're both
oh. on that part.
Performing.
Yes.
Even we could tell the difference.
Well, it's incredible music and an incredible film. The thing that I'd love for you to talk a little bit about to the audience is light in the film. And how you managed to capture those extraordinary lighting effects.
Getting up early. Turning on the camera at 4 in the morning. Watch the light come up. Basically, we were trapping light.
So it was time-lapsed. Mm. We would just set it,
we had mirrors set up throughout the room. And we would just watch the sun as it would move across through the windows. And we'd reposition mirrors just to bang it onto the set and everything.
So you do have windows in a studio.
When I came windows, there,
you kept all the curtains firmly closed. So you'd set up a mirror 4 o'clock in the morning, you'd catch a particular angle of the sun. Was it planned or was it see what you get?
Well, we knew the trajectory from having lived in that studio for years. We knew that there were three windows so it would rise in the east, slowly make its way across to the other two windows, and then we lost the sun for the rest of the day until it came around at the end of the day, and it would just pierce in through two buildings like for an hour at the end of the day with a west light. But so we basically just worked. We had a live action set up for her. We had the animation set up, and we had the wall also. So we knew exactly at what hours that we had to switch quickly to doing other bits in the set
or bring in the live actors. And we always, because we're conserving film, so we shot her at 9 frames a second or 12 frames a second, just told her, move real slow.
But then also on the sequences with her fingers, she couldn't be spastic enough. So he did all the close-ups.
Oh, which is also at 9 frames a second? Everything's at 9 frames a second.
I forget. Yeah, it must have been. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, it's an amazing film. And the music, I think, is a huge part of it, the power of it.
Yeah.
But I have to say that when you then get to watch The Comb, which is the music so much quieter and more spare, you start to hear this incredible sound design. And I wanted to talk about your use of sound, because you know, I work in the Hollywood realm where sound either has to be there very obviously or not there at all.
Yeah.
These are sort of ghosts of sounds. Yeah. They're things that you know, I think of the hands hitting the ladder. It's such
yes,
a delicate,
exactly.
tiny sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Who does your sound? How do you make that happen? How did you come to that sort of sound design?
We met Larry Sider, who was also a fellow American, on our very, very first film. He worked with us with the sound, and I could just talk to him, and he would come to the studio, and he, knowing the images, he knew we wanted something very organic, so we would use just elements in our studio, you know, making, you know, all kinds of intimate little sounds. The door banging was, we had a door that blew in the wind, so it just constantly, so we just picked it off. The bells were the wind blowing through the chimes. He said, that's great, we'll go for that. So we wanted to really, with Walzer, he beautifully charts a sort of dark fairy tale world, and I think that's what we wanted, just to create this lightness of what the fairy tale, something that we'd never really, I think we shied away from fairy tale stuff because it's dangerous. you can fall into a bad traps with it, but I think with this one, we felt that, you know, working with the princeling, who's like the fairy tale figure, arriving, trying to pursue the Sleeping Beauty, and of course in the background is this dark ogre-like figure who's constantly ranting and intimidating, and then, yeah, that's it.
And what's its...
We keep it loose.
very loose, I was going to say. What's its relationship with your feature film, Instituto Benjamento?
Well, it was a pilot film for it. We wanted to work out some ideas of how we might incorporate animation into the feature film. In the end, we didn't. We almost used invisible animation. There was just a few sequences in Benjamento, but it was just sort of getting the lay of the land and seeing if we could create this kind of fairy tale-ish, this in-between world, which we felt was between dream, between sleep and wakefulness. And Walzer very much talked about this, literally a threshold space between the two, wakefulness and sleep, that the things you're aiming for, that you can create this kind of realm, but it's abstract in a way.
Well, I think animation seems perfect for that because it's unreal in some way.
You're halfway there already.
The form of it. Why, when you made the feature, did you use less animation than you planned?
I think that was something practical that it wouldn't have permitted it. I mean, there's an opening sequence with, we couldn't do an exterior sequence with a character running around a building. We animated it. But nobody knows that. You just accept it. You hear footsteps and you think,
right,
we really found somebody to run around the building.
So when you're describing the sound work, Larry Sider, and he's a sound guy, he works on regular movies
well. Yeah.
But as you describe your process, you're talking about recording sounds with him in your studio. I mean, that's not the way it's normally done. You know, normally you give a list, people go off, and you have no idea what they're doing, and they come back with a set of sounds. So I think that clearly, you know, you two are very involved with Larry in terms of finding those little sounds. I'm especially interested in the way he's able to come up with a sound, the way you're able to come up with a sound to synchronize with the camera movement. So when the camera sort of drops, and you hear this almost a machine noise.
Yeah,
we're very keen on the we always call the camera the third puppet, that it has a presence.
And that is it because you're mixing your metaphors because you're counting the two of you as puppets and it's the third? I wondered that after we made the film, but there's a slight peculiarity.
I'm not sure
why
we said that.
Because you don't always have two puppets.
But I mean, the two of, like in your documentary, unlike Hollywood, our camera, one of our closest assistant built all the mechanisms out of an old 16mm projector. He ripped it apart so we could single frame movements left, right, up, down, all that. And we thought, what a challenge, and that we would do honor to this industriousness of his part, and like the little fingers that you depicted.
Yeah.
We said we want to hand it to depict boredom. It was for a Michael Penn video, and he made it out of a typewriter machine. We just took apart a typewriter.
That's Ian.
Ian Nicholas. So he liked, and then with a little girl in Stillenach 2, when she had to go up and down, we did a mechanism in the bin, and he made the feet with a bit of a yogurt cup that just sort of slipped up and down. And we're in paradise.
Did he make that board for you that you do the with all the millimeters marked up, that you do the camera?
No, that we did.
That's your own thread. And I mean, seeing you do that, I mean, it's so incredibly arduous. I mean, I had the funny experience of, you know, coming to your studio and trying to, I don't know, reveal all your secrets or whatever. And of course, what I found is the way you do these things is so completely crazy that knowing how it's done is of no use to you whatsoever. You could never begin to imitate or do it. And I wanted to know whether in your creative process, I mean, just being honest, do you have a moment where you say, well, it'd be lovely if the camera tracked that way, and you think, oh, Christ, you know, it's really going to be a hell of a... I mean, in other words, when you do a dolly shot, it's an incredible decision.
Yeah,
it's a days-long decision. Yeah. It's not frivolous.
It's both a mathematical one, because there's all the variations of saying it's 2 millimeters or 3 or 2.5 in order to meet the tracking forward, which might be in 5s or 1s. But they all have to meet at the same point, and if they don't, you know,
you have to do it again.
You have to do it again. So we spent half the time doing mathematics.
Right. And back, I mean, when I think with certainly the first of these films, you wouldn't have even had a video assist or a video tap on the camera.
No.
So how would you work? You would literally work for a day, take it to the lab.
You just work completely by radar.
Mm.
You'd take it to the lab, and then you'd wait till the next morning, pick up the rushes, and then you'd, you know, lace it up, thinking like, oh God, is this going to work? Did it work? Of course, if it didn't, then you said, okay, back to the drawing board. You had to reshoot it. Now with video assist, you know, we can find out instantly if the shot was good, how to improve it. You can work so much quicker, but back then,
you had to really commit to an idea.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
I mean, we still use radar.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think, you know, we spoke about this earlier on when we were talking. It allows for accident. I mean, what I love about all three of these films, and the reason I chose these three in particular, is of all of your work, for me, they have extremely organic quality. Yeah. There are things that they don't feel accidental, but they feel like they were informed by accident, informed by circumstance. I mean, lighting. Well, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I would just say that. I mean, we talked about this before, but the idea of the studio as being a kind of a laboratory where you can really try things out and discover is a thing that when you're doing a live action film and you're working, as you know, you have a 30-day shoot or whatever it is, you can't just turn around and say, oh, do you mind if we do a little bit of experimentation here? Everybody can go off while the twins think a little bit about, we could invent something here. What do you think? So you can't, but with animation, you know, it's...
Nobody's looking.
You don't think twice, and you're right. Nobody's looking. So it's just the two of us. And I think if you'd come in and saw us contemplating on a tracking shot, we'd probably look to each other and say, maybe we better not do it. Because it would look stupid. No, because in a way, when you're doing a tracking shot, it's like you really have to go into a kind of a gentle trance, because it's like you go into a rhythm. You know, so it's the person, you lower, get down on your hands and knees, and then push it. The camera like 1 millimeter, then you have to get up, so you might have to rack it so the camera the you're rising on the frame a little bit
and tilted,
and you might be pulling focus, you know, and then you go to animate the puppet and maybe do something with the lights. So it's this long thing that you, so rhythm you have to get into,
yeah.
And you just
and then you say, did you move the puppet? And he goes,
I forget. Yes, a lot of silly things like that, but you've got to be really focused, or if the phone rings, you go, oh, fuck, did I move?
Right.
So we always have a little sign which we put on the trigger that would say, our shot or our move, and you flip it, but then we forget, did we
flip the sign? You've just added another thing, yes. Wow. Well, it's an interesting question, because when I watch the films, they feel limitless. It feels like absolutely anything can happen in this kind of magical realm that you're creating. Yeah. And so, like, when I make a live action feature, I'm very aware of the limitations that I'm dealing with. When I watch your animation, it feels like you have no such limitations, but you must. I mean, what are the limitations you're aware of when you're making it, or do you feel you could go anywhere with it?
I don't know. I think you have certain optimisms about. I mean, you don't see the shots that we had to leave out because it didn't work. So there's a lot of that. But like, for instance, when you're animating like the dandelion scene, we shot it in reverse, and Timothy was just like, hold his breath, go in with a tweezer and pull out one filament, you know, and then you're racking focus. So you just had a hunch that what could it happen? Would it work in the way you wanted? So there are just a lot of hunches that you make and you go for it. And you win some and you lose a lot.
Well, in Street of Crocodiles, a lot of it feels extremely carefully thought out, very planned. Yeah. But as I'm watching it, I'm watching it on the print, it was amazing. It was like watching it for the first time again. But when you get to the elements, like the screws unscrewing, I mean, obviously that's not coming from Bruno Schultz. That's not coming. Some idea you have, and the dandelion as well. It's sort of, how do you incorporate those kind of inspirations
and experiments, really, into
something that you must have had to plan very carefully?
Well, I know Schultz, I mean, his treatise on mannequins, dummies, was a great influence, because he talks about the matter's never dead, that there's this constant migration of forms, and that
the poetic ascension of the everyday, I think, was
so we would try to find visual equivalents of that. So the dandelion could represent that, or the screws were something that was something constantly in migration, constantly finding new something to fasten into, desert, and move on. So I think they were just trying to find little metaphors like that would express Schultz without being, you know, too ponderous or
just illustrating.
Yeah. Mm. And then trying to weave those themes throughout the film so that you felt that everything was in flux all the time. It's, you know, relentless flux.
Even the child at the end recognizes it when the dying character and all the screws start deserting it and start moving past him as he bags his head into death.
Yeah.
Do you test things like that? Like when you have the idea to do the screws?
You just do it.
You just go
for it.
You have to.
Yeah.
Oh.
And when the dandelion's decaying, you didn't presumably sit there for months and have them actually decay.
But we had a very fine like mesh above the scene with like black powder paint. And we just go up and go, just tick it gently on every frame, and it would just slowly just that fall pressure. And just literally the weight of the dust would just make the dandelions turn
frame
gray
by frame.
Frame by frame. So it was just again a hunch that
And what's your hit rate with hunches? Do most of them
pretty
work,
good actually.
Yeah. I would be interested to see the outtakes, actually. Just that would actually be pretty fascinating.
Actually, there's not a lot, actually.
No?
Actually, there's not. Surprisingly, there wasn't.
Yeah.
But it's true that it is so arduous that you don't sit around making, oh, let's have a go at this. You don't think of it. You don't treat it lightly.
Right.
You really go for it.
What are the creatures sort of moving in the dust, those wood lights.
They were real insucking.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we felt bad about that.
Yeah, we let them go at the end.
Yeah.
We had a fly that died, though. Right.
Yeah, that fly, he flew in overnight. So the next day we arrived there, and we think, like, what's he doing in there? So we just turned the camera on, and, you know, he's zooming around all over the place. So then we put some black camera tape, because there was a crack in the glass. Mm. And then a little bit later, he was stuck on it. He was dead. So that camera tape's pretty tough stuff.
How do you achieve those effects of the blurring of motion with the hands in the comb, or the monkey with the symbols? Oh, yeah. How is that done?
Well, with
animation.
No, but with that, well, he.
I'm asking for the benefit of the audience. I actually have no idea exactly how you did that. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, with the shutter held open in some way.
Yeah, longer exposure.
Particularly with things where the objects are in air as well, in midair.
Yeah.
Are you suspending them from wires?
Yeah, yeah.
How is that?
Yeah, just.
Invisible thread.
As they say, invisible thread, which isn't invisible, but as we had hoped. No, you just use a long, like a 1 second exposure.
Mm-hmm.
But animation's great like that, so you can do a 10 second exposure on the Mitchell, or depending how much wildness you want.
But then we found out that when we did the documentary on Anamorphosis, we did 10 second exposures to get.
The depth of
field.
Mm.
And of course the technician in the lab said your color curves are going to go bending, and they did. They went from black to red,
right,
to pink. And we said it's because it's a 10 second exposure.
You said you can't do that, boys. Right. Advice.
Interesting. Well, yeah, and I don't think there are very many filmmakers who ever would have found out that was an issue, 10-second exposures. You're referring to the film about Anamorphosis is on the Blu-ray, pumping the Blu-ray here, that we're putting out with all the films on in high def. But it's looking at Anamorphosis in the art world, and you do these great shots where the camera tracks away from the picture and into the eye line to let it stack up, which shooting in a real place with a very large wall, huge exposure time necessary.
But,
it's a stunning.
Well, we actually shot one of those scenes in Rome at the very top of the Spanish Steps. There's a French convent, and one of the most famous anamorphic paintings, corridors is there. So we're there with a film crew. We have a one-day shoot, and we shoot this scene really beautifully, and then we suddenly, I said to Timothy, I said, you know, they're going to think it's a puppet set that we just filmed it in the studio. So we got the nun to walk into this. We said, just walk down the scene and go in that door there. And then she opens the door and she goes in. And then when later with Larry, when we did the sound effects, we said, listen, why can't you, maybe you could just get a sound
of a Vespa.
A Vespa going by in the background.
Just so the door opens.
So he goes into the film library, and the first thing that comes up, it says Vespa in Rome. And we said, there it is, go for it. And it worked perfect.
Did you make that before the comb? Did it inspire? I was wondering if it inspired the background of the comb.
It was exactly the same time. I think it was just after the comb. Literally, like, it was the next film we did.
Yeah. So those background, they are anamorphic.
Slightly.
Yeah. They have a feel of...
Yeah, we just... just slightly
clumsy anamorphic.
And on
I know, because in the black and white scenes, we borrowed a lens from the it was the animators who were at the end of our corridor, and they said, oh, we've got this old anamorphic lens, and we said, oh, can we borrow it? But of course it couldn't hold focus, so that's why they're slightly soft, a lot of those. If we got in too close, we just went for it anyway, but they're very soft, and it's a shame, because you just couldn't get it in focus. You had to rack several, so we gave up in the end.
I thought it was all on purpose myself.
Well,
disillusioned me. It looked beautiful, and I really enjoy seeing in absentia projected anamorphic. You didn't shoot it with an anamorphic lens, but you projected that.
We knew from the day one that we were going to project it anamorphic.
Yeah, it's an incredible look. It's an incredible look. Well, I'm running out of time here, so. Since I can't ask you what it all means, I'll ask you the next most irritating question I guess, that I guess asked all the time, which is, can you talk about anything you're doing now or what you're working on next?
Well, we're working with you, aren't we?
Right now. If you'd rather not answer, I completely understand.
Yeah, we're trying to do another Bruno Schultz adaptation, The Sanatorium Under the Sign of the Hourglass. And
and that's what, in my short film, those puppets are part of that.
Some of those puppets are, exactly, right. Exactly, yeah. So we've shot 20 minutes of it, but Keith's hustling for some more money, so.
There you go.
There we go.
Contributions exactly. Here. Yeah. And yes, apologies for the spoilers in my film. Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for everybody for coming, and I just want to thank both of you for all the incredible work over the years. It's been an absolute inspiration to myself and many other filmmakers. And so thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.